90% of all scientists that have ever been alive are alive today. That's a lot of information. But don't panic. It's not an exact science.
Hey, Shannon, how are you?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
I can't complain. I'm bracing for, I guess, traffic.
I see that you're also planning a little eclipsy trippy.
I am. I thought I would be clever and, you know, do things that would make it where it was easier to travel. And apparently that plan has been foiled too. So we'll see what happens.
Everyone's plans seem to be getting foiled. And I think I'm going to be foiled by, you know, clouds. But we'll see. I'm sure there'll be much grousing or excitement about it next week. We'll see.
Yeah, the model runs for Texas don't look promising.
Yeah, they sure don't. And then I think it's 5 days out. Something can happen.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, the models aren't great, but we were looking at, my plan was to fly down to Russellville. And I was like, oh, it's, you know, a tiny, like, remote airport. There's not going to be anybody there. Like, we'll just pop in, we'll watch the eclipse, and come home. And I called the airport manager this morning, and he said, oh, we're going to start parking planes on the grass at 6 a.m. We're expecting 200 to 300 aircraft.
I'm guessing that is probably 200 to 300% more than they're used to.
Yeah, there's normally
a random, you know, Monday.
Three or four planes on the ramp there. So that's going to be fun.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah. Hopefully we won't be disappointed when we chat again next week.
Right. And, you know, this eclipse has been incredibly well publicized. Obviously, we've known it's coming for a long time. But there's been a lot of media attention going on around it. And it's actually a good time to not talk about eclipses, but to talk about media with this week's guest, which is Alexis Dahl, to talk about science communication, YouTube, and the Rocks of Michigan.
Yay! Welcome, Alexis!
Hi, thanks. Also, that was such a smooth transition. Well done.
You know, we have 10 years of segue practices. Yeah, we really like to play on those. So we appreciate your appreciation of our hard work.
Anytime.
So, Alexis, I found your YouTube channel a while back, and I believe it was the Torch Lake videos that you had made was the first ones that the algorithm suggested. And I was super impressed with the storytelling that you did, and that's why I wanted to get in touch with you. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe introduce yourself like we were on a panel.
Yeah, well, first, thank you. It's always just such a joy to hear when people enjoy the videos that I sometimes feel like I'm throwing them into the void. But in any case, yeah, hi, I'm Alexis Dahl. I am a professional full-time science communicator, so I don't have one field of science that I specialize in, but most of the things I'm writing turn into videos on YouTube. So right now, I am a freelance writer for a couple of shows, freelance writer and script editor for a couple of shows, including Crash Course and SciShow and some other folks. And then the big project is what you came across, John, which is this YouTube series that I produce that's about science and history stories in Michigan. So academics-wise, going with my like hodgepodge generalist thing, I graduated from the University of Michigan with a degree in biopsychology, cognition, and neuroscience. Oh. I was collecting letters to put on my diploma, apparently.
Yeah, and that's a big one.
Yeah, it truly is. Yeah, and then personally, I'm a lifelong Michigander and currently live in the Upper Peninsula.
All right. My husband is from an adjacent state. And yeah, the Upper Peninsula is its whole separate thing, right? I think you even have some videos on it.
It is. I really had no idea. It's a whole new world compared to Southeast Michigan.
And I mean, that's my also favorite thing to do is I love states that you can make your hand into the state, right?
So like, yes.
I live in the middle of Oklahoma. It's super easy. You just stick that one finger out there. And then obviously the mitten is a big one and it just cracks me up every time. I love it.
Oh, I love it too. It's so convenient.
It is. Exactly.
Yeah, so you said that you had this degree that it had a lot of letters in it, but science communications wasn't anywhere in there. So what was the path to get into doing science communications and the work you're doing now?
Yeah, in some ways it was a very twisty, windy path. And in some ways it worked out way faster than I ever imagined it would. So going into college, I was really convinced, you know, in all of my 18-year-old wisdom, that I was going to be either a neurologist or get a PhD in neuroscience. And like, that was my life path. Fast forward a couple of years and I'd interned or done classes in like labs and I'd shadowed doctors. And I was like, oh no, like I'm not well suited for either of these things, which was kind of horrifying, like 2 full years into a degree program. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, it was at that point that a few things happened and I sort of realized like science communication is an actual job. Like the History Channel science videos I watched with my dad as a kid didn't like come out of the void. And for me, that was a moment of like, oh, this is perfect. I love writing, you know, I love learning things and I love telling people about things that I've learned. And my pie in the sky dream, I was always like, well, I really like video. Like I love just sort of, you can see a host, you can, you know, like hear the tone of their voice. It's just a whole different experience than print. And my pie in the sky dream was like, well, I'd love to do science video someday. And it would be really cool to do something like some of the shows that I watch on YouTube that were around in like 2014 or so. And by some incredible like chance event, I ended up getting an internship with like the Smithsonian Science Education Center a year later. And then right after I graduated, a freelance writing position opened up for the YouTube channel SciShow Space, which was like a show I loved. And it actually lined up with my senior year of undergrad. My student job was writing for the aerospace department. I sort of like by luck talked my way into a position there. Yeah. So just all of these things sort of fell together shortly after I finished college. So much for being a neurologist, but I am having a much better time.
I find that it's so hard to speak to the role of serendipity in these things. You know, it's hard. I have all these students that are coming up that want to get jobs, and I'm like, man, if you just stick with it, like, trust me, you're going to find something that you like. And that's so hard to tell someone that hasn't gone through it. But I love to hear that from you, that that's sort of exactly, you know, it wasn't what you had planned, but it turned out even better than you could have hoped, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was speaking to some students at University of Michigan a few weeks ago, and sort of one of the pieces of advice I gave was like, just keep your eyes open. Like if there is not an opportunity already, there might be a way to make your own opportunity.
Right.
And I feel like that happened to me a lot when I was getting ready to finish college.
I feel like that's exactly what John did as well. So, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And, you know, there is a tendency. I think this was an idea that Adam Savage put in his book of like, there's this tendency when you look back and somebody says, well, how'd you get to doing what you're doing now? You tell this story in such a way that it's where you're at now is the logical conclusion. It's this linear mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. And that pretty much is never the case.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I love playing that game of like, man, if I can go back and tell 20-year-old me, like, you know, that I just met this person or that I just did this thing, like, yeah, it would be great. But
well, I think we did have
relate to that.
Yeah.
I think we did have a, maybe it's when Shannon and I did interviews of each other, like way back in the series, of what was the weirdest job that you've ever had that was not related to your field. So do you have any that are in there, some just odd jobs that you ended up having at some time?
Yeah. I mean, I had, especially early on in college, just your classic collection of weird jobs. Just I needed money. The worst one by far, and I think I only lasted a few weeks before like the heavens opened and thankfully another opportunity showed up, was I spent a very short amount of time doing like telemarketing for the university, and it was so terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was calling people out of the blue, and you had to ask them, like, 3 times to donate money. Like,
oh, my gosh.
Oh, it was so bad. Like, it bought me groceries, and that was all I needed.
Yep, but, exactly. You gotta do what you gotta do. Oh, no. We just had giving day yesterday, and I will say, I got an awful lot of phone calls and emails, and I try to keep that in mind, that they're just doing their jobs.
Yeah, they're just doing their best.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, that's amazing. There's just such a great amount of awesome information on your show, on your YouTube channel. And when John said, like, take a look at this, this is someone we should interview, and I definitely lost a lot of time down that wormhole. So,
well, thanks.
You're welcome. But, like, YouTube is a very interesting medium for me, because it's interesting that, like, my students all automatically go to it. And I don't know, you know, I'm 40 something years old, and it's not like my first go-to. And so when you were thinking about the science communication thing, like you said, you also like did a lot of writing. It was like videos the end all of this for you? Or like, when did you decide that YouTube was a good platform for this?
Yeah. So YouTube, I don't think I ever intentionally was like, I want to make stuff specifically on YouTube. I think it was more of like video that appeals to me. Something I've really enjoyed about YouTube, though, is just, I think there's, for me at least, there's been more freedom to make stuff that just wouldn't fly on like traditional TV. Not in like a, you know, like getting wild here kind of way. But like when I, a couple years ago, started experimenting with like field shoots and going out into the field with an expert and talking to them there. And so much of my camera work is just so casual. It's just like, hi, I'm just like bringing you along. Let's go hang out with this cool person. And I think about like, well, you know, if that story had been on, you know, PBS or, you know, some form of traditional educational show, like there would be crews and it would look very polished and it wouldn't have that like, come follow this person around kind of feeling. Yeah, so YouTube was never like the goal, but I'm very happy to have sort of landed in this corner of media.
That's awesome. I know John uses YouTube all the time and he's always like, do you follow this channel? Do you follow this channel? I'm like, oh, am I just too old for this? And then I don't do it because this is what happens, is I lose an entire evening. But again, I learned a lot of stuff from you. So it was an okay evening.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad. That's all I aspire to, is okay.
It's the highest compliment in Oklahoma. Everything's okay.
It's true.
I love it.
So a lot of your videos, I mean, you can correct me, maybe all, are in Michigan. And we established, okay, that's where you've been. But a lot of them are geological. And I'm curious, is that, like, is geology something that has interested you? Or is it just that there's a lot of great geology around where you are? What's caused that trend in your theme or the subjects that you've chosen?
Yeah, so it's mostly the sort of like abundance of interesting stories. So to give you some background, I grew up 30, 45 minutes outside of Detroit, way down in Southeast Michigan. And the things, you know, my perspective of Michigan was that it was so boring. When I was like a teenager and I had seen a couple of other parts of the country, I was like, this place, there's nothing here. the suburb I lived in, it was like close to the Great Lakes, but not really, and close to Detroit, but not really. And it was very flat and like strip malls and movie theaters. And to me, it just felt so generic. And with geology in particular, like you in the your Michigan history unit in second or third grade or whatever, you learned like, you know, about 10,000 years ago, the glaciers came through and they carved out the Great Lakes. And now we have them, the end. And that's great. I love the Great Lakes, but there are only so many times you can hear that story growing up before you're like, sure, there was a mile of ice here once. So when I eventually moved up to the Upper Peninsula, it was in, you know, late 2020, and geologic, I guess, environment in the Western Upper Peninsula in particular is so dramatically different from the rest of the state. Most of, if you look at a bedrock map of Michigan, it's like the Lower Peninsula and the Eastern UP looks like a big bullseye. And it's the Michigan Basin, and it's just this series of receding seas from the Devonian-ish. But the Western Upper Peninsula, it's like the rocks tend to be older. There was like rifting activity that happened here a billion years ago. Just completely different stories and completely different landscape features than anything I saw growing up. So when, you know, when we moved up here, that's sort of where my video series started, which was just me looking at all these rocks I'd never seen and cliffs I'd never seen and going, what on earth happened here? And it felt like every time I looked up an answer, it was just way more interesting than I felt it had any right to be. So that's been a theme that's continued for the last few years, is everything is way too interesting.
The geologic map does look like a bullseye. I've never put that together. I just pulled that up right now. I'm like, oh yeah. I haven't spent a lot of time outside of the Detroit area in Michigan, but let me tell you, whenever I talk about glaciers in class, there are some weird little islands in the UP that just, like, you just look at the outlines on the map. You don't need to look at anything else, not the terrain, and be like, it looks like a giant piece of ice scraped through here. They're so strange to me. Are they that strange in real life?
Oh, interesting. What are, I'm going to pull up a map now.
You know, I, you know, when I looked at them, and I've brought them up in class before, like north of Sheboygan, and north east of Mackinac Island, there's that weird little cluster, like the Little LaSalle Island and Goose Island and White Loon Island. And it's just so strange.
Oh, that is interesting. So,
there you go. There's your next video.
Yeah, I think the short answer is glaciers.
Yeah, that's what I figured too. But boy, they're so pointy.
They are. Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, see? This is just a content sharing mission. That's why we
have you. I know, on, thank
so
you.
We can... So we can do that. Yeah, perfect.
That's true. And as a geophysicist, you know, you start talking about rock ages and that sort of thing. And that doesn't mean a lot to me, but...
I assumed you tuned out at Devonian when she said that.
But, you know, I do have some background in doing glacial work, and yeah, it's like what glaciers can do is really amazing. And yet you have a ton of cool geology around you. So I guess that sort of makes sense. But did you have any real curiosity about geology beforehand, or was it just when you moved up there and saw all of the weird rocks and cliffs?
Yeah, I had gotten the lightest exposure to geology. Again, one of those like coincidence feeling things right before we moved up here. So right before I moved to the UP, I was working. So at the time I was working for the YouTube channel SciShow. I was on their editorial team and having a ball. And with SciShow, we were working on this like new sort of project. It was a field shoot, which didn't normally happen. SciShow's usually shot on a green screen. And I ended up writing and co-hosting, which was also very new, this mini series where for 3 episodes, we went out to Olympic National Park in Washington. And the whole series was like 3 episodes exploring interesting geology in that part of Washington. So that was sort of my first, like, I think a big thing for me was that for that series, I had spent months like reading and researching all the stuff about rocks on the West Coast, and then actually getting on a plane, flying there and seeing the stuff in person of like, oh my gosh, like this is where the story happened. Felt like a powerful moment for me. Before that point, I wrote a lot about space and psychology and, you know, weird, cool animals, basically like stuff, psychology aside, a lot of stuff I would never get to interact with probably in my life. So this experience of like, oh, like these are the rocks, I can touch them, this is the basalt, this is cool. that for me was like, oh, geology's pretty neat. Did not realize this. Excellent. So yeah, when I moved up to the Upper Peninsula, it felt like I was like primed and ready to ask questions.
See, John, geology is really neat.
Geology is really neat. I mean, I totally agree. I just, you know, look at it with math. So
that's good too.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, Shannon teaches field camp for OU. So she spends a lot of time teaching people how to do field work that don't have much experience out in the field. So have you got like a little geology kit together now, like most people accumulate once they start going out into the field?
I haven't yet. I'm...
Oh, no.
I know.
You will soon.
the slippery slope approaches.
That's exactly right. And then you can spend an hour talking about hammers, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We indeed have.
Yes.
Yes. I love that.
Oh my gosh, that makes it sound so boring. We have a show about hammers. No, it's an entire hour. Yes.
And there's vigorous debate about the correct type of rock hammer for the type of rock that you're using.
Sedimentary, obviously, but anyway, go ahead.
Right. No, and you know, it's geologists too, that's always fun to go, because you always come back with a backpack that weighs 80 pounds, or you're trying to get through TSA with a bunch of rock.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely been stopped with those before. So.
Oh, yeah.
But that's wonderful.
But I imagine you've probably got a whole different kit that you have to carry, because you're taking your viewers along for the ride with you. So what do you take into the field to be able to shoot your videos? Because the production quality, you know, the video quality, the sound quality, everything's great. So how do you do that when you're outdoors and not always in the best of conditions?
Yeah. Well, first, thanks. I'm really happy to hear that. My professional bread and butter is writing, and I feel like I've just been figuring out all the production stuff. So I'm glad it's coming through. Okay. So my field kit isn't huge, which is nice. I finally got a proper backpack that fits all my gear. And then I definitely overloaded it, which I found out as I was like hiking up the Huron Islands last summer, and it was like 80 degrees and uphill all the way. So I've learned some things. So I film on a DSLR. I usually bring along a couple of lenses, especially if I think I'm going to need a zoom lens, if I'm going to be far from something. And then, DSLR. I've got a couple of just like wireless microphone packs that weren't super expensive. I've been fascinated by how many things you can buy on like a mild budget. So just like a couple of collar mics and a fancy digital camera and... 25 years of playing with cameras and camcorders will take you a long way.
Right. Excellent. So that like leads me to ask, you know, your videos range in length, but they're not super long, but like how much editing do you wind up doing? Whenever we have other, you know, podcast people on here too, it's always interesting to see how that works for people. 'Cause John and I don't have a lot of extra stuff outside of like what you get on this show. Like, do you come back with these? I imagine it depends, but you know, with like five times more stuff than you actually wind up putting out, or?
Yeah, it really depends. So if there are a couple of videos where I've clearly like, or at least clearly to me, have prepared ahead of time for the field shoot, and those it's like, I show up on site, I've done my research, I've got my script, I'm just like running lines. But when I'm doing interviews with people, I often end up with so much extra footage. I sometimes toy with the idea of like, maybe someday I'll just go back and release like an hour long cut of several videos. But you can imagine also how long that would take, which is why I haven't done it yet. But yeah, people are so interesting. It's hard to pare stuff down into a story sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, I really appreciate, like, we clearly don't do that. You know, we just put out an hour-long podcast every week. But there's...
I love that, though.
I mean, we've been going a while. It took some time. But yeah, there was a couple of podcasters we were involved with, and they're... We asked that same question, and I think John and I both just kind of sat there stunned because they had, you know, for their hour-long show, it was like 6 hours of recording, and we're like, no, nope, we're not that committed.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I know that we do a little bit of video production for trying to promote some of our products at work, and it always stuns me how long it takes, one, to get everything recorded, especially if you're like me and can't spit out a sentence correctly, much less two or three in a row. But then how long the editing process takes, finding the right B-roll and just getting everything to look decent. So for a video that you put out, how long do you think you take to edit, you know, a minute of content?
Oh, yeah. That's it. It depends so much. Because like sometimes a minute of content is mostly me talking, and sometimes I put a picture on screen, and sometimes a minute is like a heavily animated sequence that I've gone through. Right. I feel like on average, I think editing a whole video, let's call it like 10-ish, 10, 12, 15 minutes, can often be like a 20 to 30 hour project.
Wow.
That's yeah. impressive. My computer and I are well acquainted.
Were those skills you picked up when you were working for the other different channels, or was it something that you had dabbled in before? Because like committing to editing, I feel like, is a thing I don't want to do, and that's a big deal.
Yeah, it was very much a hobby from like
my
middle school days, actually.
All right. Okay, so do we need to bring up AV Club? Is that a thing?
No, that was not a thing for me.
Okay.
Would I have joined it? Probably, though.
I always find that this is a very contentious contentious thing to bring up around people that are into editing is AV Club, because there's always like, oh, but Sarah Marshall got president and I was only vice president and it's my favorite.
Oh, no.
But that's good. That's good. You went unopposed for.
Yes, I had other middle school band drama. That was my middle school drama.
Oh yeah. All right. I played saxophone. I got you.
Oh, love it.
I played clarinet. What did you play?
Oh, I played French horn.
Okay.
Oh, there we French go. Horns. We need to sit behind you. And your spit valves, gross.
Oh, so much. And all the tubes. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that, since you've done a lot of writing for shows as well as producing and all the work on your own, you talk to a lot of people and you interact with scientists, you interact with experts in their field. How can how can scientists do a better job of communicating with anyone, because we're generally not very great at it?
Yeah, why are we so bad at it?
Yeah, so I can't generalize on behalf of all scientists in the world.
We can,
but if you had to, no.
Sure. Yeah, so I can at least tell you one of the something I'm so glad I learned very early on as a science writer. That was taught to me by people just so much better at this than I was. It was really drilled into me whenever I was like pitching an idea or like writing, you know, the intro to something, especially, to really make sure I could communicate like the so what, or really clearly answer the question like, why does this matter? Why should I care? Which sounds so blunt, but like, yeah, there's this degree of like, cool, you might be doing this incredible, amazing research, but me, who knows nothing about your field, like, I'm probably interested, I'm probably willing to listen to you, but like, why should I? Like, why is what you're doing important in some way? Yeah, and I think a lot of times, I mean, I don't feel like scientists fall into this trap. I feel like a lot of media takes the easy way out with that. Especially on short form videos these days, like the YouTube shorts and the TikTok and what have you, people's hook is always just like, you know, you need to know this, or like, here are, don't miss out on these three things. Which, like, yeah, that's communicating why what you're about to say matters. But, like, if you can get two or three levels below that, I feel like that will set you up for a lot of success. That, and then just being able to read the room and know when you're going to, when you're going too far down the rabbit hole.
Oh no, the glazed looks are what everyone lives for.
You're like, yeah, I got them now. Exactly. They got the donut eyes.
Oh, that's so good. I find, and John, I'm sure this is, you observe this as well, you know, even in, you know, the PhD program that you're in, oftentimes just that question, just the so what, is the hardest one to answer, actually. And it's a thing that, like, I really try to get my students to remember that through that whole process, right? You know, I have many graduate students over the lifetime of doing this, but they get so bogged down with the minutia of what they're doing, it becomes very difficult to answer that, like, larger so what question. And so that's really cool to hear that that is something that you also focus on, because it shouldn't be hard for us, but somehow it's the hardest thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
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 It's that one thing.
Yeah. And for me as a writer, it's like, it's so easy to get lost and like, well, is this sentence accurate? Did I phrase this in the best way I could? And to, you know, realize, like, at the end of the day, of course people want to consume something that is, like, accurate, but they also want to consume something that's meaningful. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how can you check both of those boxes?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's exactly it. We have participated in our university. I think this is a nationwide thing. They now have a 3-minute thesis competition. And I think this is one of the best things that we have done in science, period. I think everyone should be forced to do it. I don't think it should just be a regular competition for fun. And it's summing up your thesis or your dissertation in 3 minutes.
Oh, cool.
Here you go. You have 3 minutes. It is every PhD student here. It's not any particular, it's not science, it's everyone. And then you move on to, like, the national competitions for that. And it's great that you win money, and that's wonderful. But, man, I think the science communication aspect of that is invaluable.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Mm-hmm. Did they have that, John, when you were doing your PhD?
No, I mean, we were still, you know, carving into stone tablets.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a fairly new thing, but I think it's so cool. And I just love going to those competitions. Number one, to see what everyone's working on, but also to say, look, all of these scientists in all of these realms, or, you know, philosophers, everyone, like, we all struggle with those same communication issues, which is, yeah, 3 minutes. Why does what you do matter?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm curious how much of the communication gap in science comes from, you know, as a PhD student, you're writing a lot of research papers to go in peer-reviewed journals, and you would think that they give a prize for who can jam the most jargon into a 150-word abstract possible, and that's really what you're kind of trained to do.
Hmm.
I think that's part of our problem.
I think so too, yeah.
So when you're writing for, you know, trying to convey a complex concept, is mm-hmm. there anything that, you know, any advice you can give us, anything that you wish you had known a long time ago?
Yeah. So I feel like this answering the so what has been a huge lesson. But when it comes to complex things, something I've realized, and I learned this a lot when I was editing scripts for SciShow specifically, because I did that for a few years and, you know, hundreds of videos later, I really realized that it's possible to write an explanation for a complex topic in a way that sounds so simple, and you read it and you're like, yeah, I know how this thing works. And then you look back at what you just said and you're like, I don't understand a word that just came out of my mouth, actually. Sorry, I feel like I've learned, I'm not confident I truly understand something until it's often like walk over to my husband and be like, hey, I'm going to tell you all about, I don't know what, this weird binary star system. And then I just talk at him for like 45 seconds. And then I go, great. Does that make sense to you? And if he says no, and I can't answer his follow-up questions, then I'm like, okay. I need to do more reading. I need to reassess my own understanding. Yeah.
I like that a lot, actually.
I'm going to play that clip right there from our show to every student I have from now on.
Oh, like, good.
You should be able to do this.
Was it?
And then they'll say, we don't have any friends that are outside of this room because we're here studying all the time.
Was it Donald Knuth or somebody that had the rubber ducky or teddy bear or something that you had to outside their office and you had to explain your question that you wanted to ask at office hours to the teddy bear or ducky before you could go in?
Gosh.
And most of the time you solved your own problem.
That oh my is gosh. So amazing. I'm looking that up and bringing a teddy bear.
So, you know, it sounds like you're working in a lot of different programs. You're in a lot of different scripts. You're doing your own work. It's a lot to keep straight. What's something that you just couldn't do your job without?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you two answers, the like practical one and the one that's going to sound corny, but I really mean it. Okay. The practical one is some sort of project management something. I've like kept track of stuff in Excel spreadsheets. I've used Airtable. I've used Notion, just some sort of space to get all these thoughts and projects out of my brain is instrumental for my job. But the corny, but I mean it answer is I really couldn't do my job without all of the people who watch the stuff that I get to work on. Like really it would just be a hobby. And like, that's what this Michigan series started out as, is me like looking at this new place I lived and making these silly little videos for like a couple hundred people. And I was happy with that. And that was the end of it. But yeah, like without people being interested and sharing them with friends and writing in with, I get so many good stories and questions from people. And yeah, without that kind of support, like it would still be me just doing a little hobby thing. Like it literally wouldn't be my job. So yeah, good people and a good project management software are my two answers.
Oh, that's absolutely amazing though.
What are you using right now for project management? I'm just curious. I nerd out about that a lot.
Yeah, John doesn't care about the people part. He's very interested in that software thing.
Yeah. So my program of the moment that I've been experimenting with is Toggle, T-O-G-G-L. Okay. I really like, there's a couple of things. It's got like a tracking extension that I've used for years, that I just like pop up to a little button in my browser and type in like, I'm going to prep for this podcast now. And it keeps track of how long I do that for. But then with Toggle Plan, they one have really nice options for teams of one, which a lot of softwares don't. And it lets you be like, okay, great. I have 40 hours in this week. I think this project is going to take 3 hours. This one's going to take five. I'm going to work on this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And it just helps me see what's coming up and also when I have over or under scheduled myself. So I'm a big fan.
Oh, that's awesome. Very interesting. Does it have a thing where it can zap you if you spend too much time, you know, not on your YouTube channel, but doing something else?
It does not, unfortunately. Oh. I have to do that myself. It's very annoying.
That's the kind of software I'm interested in. For my students, obviously.
Of course, just for them.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean, this may kind of play into another question that we had, which was, what's a technology that you're excited about right now?
Yeah, that question makes me laugh. So despite how on the internet my job is, I'm a very like slow and reluctant adopter of technology.
Yes.
I was thinking about this and I was like, you know, we're a buy used cars family. And I've become the person where I'm like, if a car was made after 2016, it has too many bells and whistles.
Oh, Oh, I love this.
So that's me. Yeah, honestly, I feel like the technology I'm still most excited about is just the internet, which is also can be an unpopular thing to say as someone who works on the internet.
Right.
But yeah, when I think about technology that has the ability to bring people together and create change and bring people into communities that would be hard for them to find otherwise. Like, of course, there are quarters of the internet that are kind of scary and disturbing, but there are also so many more, like, beautiful corners that make the world better and share knowledge and build community. So, yeah, that's me. Me and my lack of other technology are just very happy about the internet.
So, that makes me so happy.
I mean, there are a ton of corners of the internet. Like, you want to know basically anything. Somebody has asked it on Reddit, or there's a YouTube video that has like 6 views. Yep. That's exactly how you replace, you know, this thing in your electric fireplace or whatever. There's a ton of information out there, but how do you get connected with your corner? So, you know, your videos, they have, I would say, a pretty large audience of people that are interested in Michigan, people that are interested in geology, but how do you, how are you sure they find you?
Yeah. So I am also terrible at marketing.
You are my people, Alexis. Just totally.
Well, good. Yeah, yes. I was talking with a colleague about this recently. She is into marketing, and I was like, should I call her? I've gotten so lucky with. I think that's part of the reason why I said I couldn't do my job without the people who watch it. To some degree, I've gotten really lucky with like the algorithm and all knowing and all mysterious. There was a period of a few weeks in late 2022 where YouTube just started recommending the heck out of a couple of videos, and that made a huge difference in my work. But often it's just like somebody, you know, it might start with somebody lives the place, you know, where I shot a video, and they go, oh, I always wondered about that bridge in Houghton, Michigan. And then they share that with a friend, and then they post that to the, you know, Upper Peninsula Facebook group. Yeah, I've just been delighted by how many people like find a story and resonate with it. And then something compels them to be like, I want to post this where other people can find it. So yeah, someday I should maybe probably get more into marketing. but I feel like I'm coasting on like luck and kindness and goodwill 9 days out of 10.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate to be able to say that. Like, I know that is not true for many people who make things on YouTube.
Oh, that's good, though.
Yeah, or, I mean, anywhere on the internet. But marketing is so weird. We talked to a marketing person about some of our products at our company, and, you know, they start talking about all these, like, oh, we have to get a sales funnel and, you know, landing pages and all this very complicated machinery. And I'm kind of sitting over here going, can't we just make good stuff
and
let quality speak?
That's sometimes how I feel. It's just like, can I just make a good thing and won't people just find it? Isn't that how that works? Not right. Always, but I like to hope.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I'm pro that as well. Well, thinking of finding things that work, you know, one of the things that we definitely get on our show, I mean, we've been going for a while, right? And so in this last, I don't know, however many years, a long time, right, John?
10, 11 years.
10 years?
Like yeah.
10 years? Oh my goodness. We get hyper obsessed with stuff. We've done a few like month long or many months long kind of obsessions. And so you moved to the UP, you've got this geology obsession. I mean, what's your next obsession up there? Like,
yeah.
what's after the rocks? I mean, there's nothing after rocks. They are everything, but...
That's true. Rocks are eternal. Yeah, so something I've been thinking a lot about recently and have started really finally diving into the research end, it's taken me too long, is sort of what's happening at a place in the UP called Buffalo Reef. So if you can picture the Upper Peninsula, It's way over on like the northwest side. There's another peninsula that sticks out north into Lake Superior.
Oh.
So that's the Keweenaw. And off the coast of the Keweenaw is this feature called Buffalo Reef. And it's just this little rocky reef in Lake Superior. And it's a major spawning ground for various kinds of fish, which makes it a super important site for commercial fishing and, you know, recreational fishing is very big up here. And nearby is also the Keweenaw Bay Indian community, and fishing is a huge, huge part of life for them. So the reason I've been reading so much about Buffalo Reef is because, so the Keweenaw experienced this huge copper mining boom starting in like the 1840s. And as part of the copper mining process, they would drag this rock out of the ground and they would smash it into just little tiny pieces. And the pieces with copper moved on in the process. And the rest of it, which is called stamp sand, it just looks like coarse sand. And the world slash mining companies being the organizations they were in the mid-1800s, they just took the stamp sand and sort of threw it in the nearest body of water and called it a day.
Yeah.
So what's happening now is there was a, I think it was a stamp sand processing facility near Buffalo Reef that sort of threw all the sand into Lake Superior, and the currents in the lake have been dragging it south. So it's buried like a couple of really beautiful white sand beaches over the last few decades. And there are estimates that like in the next few years, it will bury like a good portion of Buffalo Reef and make it just not a valid spawning ground anymore. So I have been, I learned about this a couple of years ago, but have finally been, you know, pulling up my sleeves and reading on it, reading about it, just trying to figure out like, there's a whole task force that has a plan for what to do about it. But I have questions of like, how do you get $2 billion to like implement your plan? And like, how does the public get involved in this? Like, do I need to be writing my, like my representatives or what's the deal? So that's something I've been thinking a lot about recently. I would love to get some of those answers and talk to the right people and like, I don't know, maybe this is where my hour long video finally comes in. But yeah, Buffalo Reef's been on my mind a lot recently.
It's so, not to bring this full circle, but no, to bring this full circle, yeah. My PhD advisor did his PhD in the Keweenaw Peninsula. So,
oh, fascinating. There we go.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It. He looked at the sedimentary nature of some of those copper deposits, and I'm a paleomagnetist, and I think he did something like that. But
yeah. Hey, cool.
Mm-hmm. We're all connected. Look at that.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. But we all do have different opinions about stuff, right? So,
oh, yeah.
Especially what you should eat after you eat cheese, right? That was the worst segue ever.
Well, but it was a segue, and that's what counts.
And that brings us to everybody's favorite segment of the show, Fun Paper Friday.
I tried so hard. She complimented us earlier, and it just didn't work out.
That's okay. Like, I think of things in baseball terms. If you're batting 500, you're golden.
That's right. Right. Oh, nobody has 500 batting averages anymore. So.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. But you don't want to bat, go out and bat after eating a whole thing of Swiss fondue.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so this paper comes from one of our favorite sources of fun papers, the BMJ Christmas Edition.
We could not exist without the BMJ Christmas Edition. Oh, I don't know if you knew about this as a form of science communication, Alexis, but this is gold.
I did. I read the paper title and I was like, what is this? And I was like, ah, oh, Christmas. I got
yeah.
it.
That's right. Whenever we like run out of ideas or whatever, we just go search the BMJ. It's fantastic. I thought we had done this one, John, but we have not done this one.
We have done other gastric function papers, but we have not done this one. It's the effect on gastric function and symptoms of drinking wine, black tea, or schnapps with a Swiss cheese fondue. Randomized controlled crossover trial by Heinrich et al.
Oh, man. I had no idea that this was a thing. I had no idea that there are, but it's not surprising that, you know, that there are very strongly held beliefs about what to consume with Swiss fondue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Alexis, are you a fondue person?
I'm a cheese person, but I'm not fancy about it. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's kind of
this was all news to me.
Right.
I'm a big fondue fan, but I don't go in for it with the forks and all that fanciness that goes along with probably what you're going to have to do in Switzerland.
Yeah, so one of the things they mention in here, not related to the gastric emptying, is that if you drop the bread in, yes! there are consequences of having to take an extra shot to go jump in an ice-cold lake.
That's exactly... I read that and was horrified. I thought, oh my gosh.
I also loved, like, a couple of sentences after that where the authors are like, but never fear, we didn't have the participants deal with any of that to avoid potential embarrassment. Like, we controlled for this, never mind.
Well, and I like how they also had to mention that, and the ethics board wouldn't have allowed that anyway.
You just got to say it right there, just to make sure. Oh my goodness, it's so funny. So, like, they say that traditionalists demand white wine, right? And then others insist you should only have black tea, which is also, I don't know, that one seems a little bit weird. And I love that they say that, you know, the alcohol part is the deal, right? Is it going to give you some gastric function issues or not? But the one questionnaire that they had, I love this. Respondents anticipated severe side effects from drinking Coca-Cola with fondue, ranging from dyspepsia to death.
I wonder, like, what do they think is happening with, like, cheese?
Like, is it death because someone is so offended you're drinking the Coca-Cola, or is it just purely, like, a CO2 reaction?
Oh, oh, that's it. It's like the people come for you. If
right,
you
yeah. I read it both ways. Read it both ways.
So,
oh, my goodness.
Somehow they got 20 people to sign up to do this, and they said, look, yeah. We're going to feed you. You're going to fast, then we're going to feed you fondue. And then you are either going to drink tea or alcohol, and the next day you're going to come back and do it again because once wasn't enough. And you'll drink the other. And they were measuring carbon isotopes to determine how fast your stomach was emptying.
This is amazing. And so when you say, so what? This is an actual real life, you know, usage of these empirical laboratory things, right? So this is why you do this stuff.
And I mean, I guess they did find out some results, which to me were not surprising, which was that alcohol generally made your gastric function not so great, and you processed this big block of cheese much more slowly.
Oh yeah. This is fantastic. That's why I drink Coca-Cola with my fondue.
I don't know. There were several sentences in here that were really, really pretty great. I think the one about the ethics committee might be my favorite, though. But also any paper where they're getting to use a breathalyzer,
exactly.
It's generally pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, it was really good.
Now, I did learn about a new scale, though, and Alexis, you may have probably already knew about this. We go on here a lot about the Likert scale, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, and here they were talking about a visual scale of 10 centimeters.
Yeah.
Have you encountered
that
before? Yeah,
that was also news to me.
Yeah. I kind of liked it. Yeah. I looked it up, and they said, well, we're going to give you, you know, a happy face on one end and a sad face on the other end, and basically just a ruler with 100 millimeters, and you point, and whatever millimeter you're pointing at, you're, you know, 27% unhappy.
Oh, I loved the quantification of that, because that's like every visit to the pediatrician or if anything's wrong, they pull out that little piece of paper. And so it's not quantified. It's just point to your smiley face. And so I thought that was a great addition to that scale. Right.
And I think it was, it's not the final sentence, but it's right before the conclusion where they talk about prolonged fullness, and then parentheses, the feared cheese baby syndrome.
Yes! Yeah, that one hit home for me. Cheese baby, burrito babies, they're all the...
You know, just embrace it.
Exactly. It's in science right there. Yeah. This is an excellent one, Sean. Good call.
Yeah. So, I mean, Alexa, did you have any other thoughts on the fondue eating?
Or science communication.
Yeah, man. All I know, so I'm going to be in Switzerland for a week this summer, and this is all I'm going to be thinking about. So I'm so glad I read this. Thank you.
Oh, excellent. You'll be like, I went on this crazy podcast.
Yeah, my husband and I are going to be having a nice dinner, and I'll be like, so let me tell you about gastric emptying, man. Exactly.
No idea how many dinners have been ruined by fun papers in both of our households.
For sure. For sure. My husband just cuts me off. He's like, I don't want to know what you talked about. Thank you for not sharing. Right.
Well, if folks would like to find you on the internet, how can they do that?
Yeah, so the two easiest places to find me are youtube.com/AlexisDahl, D-A-H-L, or you can find me more broadly at AlexisDahl.com.
All right, great. Well, thanks for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. This is great.
This was a joy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Shannon, if people want to write in about their experience with cheese fondue or anything else, how can they get a hold of us?
We are at don'tpanicgeocast@gmail.com. You can find us on X at don'tpanicgeo. I'm at Shannon Doolin. John is at geo_Lehman. And as always, thank you to our Patreon supporters for keeping us going, making great interviews like the one you just heard. You can support us there, patreon.com/don'tpanicgeo.
And until next week, remember, don't panic.
It's not an exact science.
Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed are solely ours and do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers or funding agencies.